Welcome to Hometown Alaska. I'm your host, Kathleen McCoy. Today's topic is a tough one, paying for education. School finance has already been in the headlines these past few weeks, and with Alaska's current fiscal climate, it likely will continue to hit news cycles hard. But this show is not about formulas and BSAs and political tension over price tags. This show is aimed at helping listeners see the big picture on school finance. Our goal is to talk about how to provide a good education to students in a city and a state as uniquely challenging as Anchorage and Alaska, no matter the size of the wallet. We must do this, so how? A recent news item pegged 89% of the Anchorage School District budget on personnel costs. So what does that really mean? Another recent school board discussion mentioned closing two middle schools and an elementary school rather than pay maintenance costs. How does that help? Why is it a good idea? Here to sort through the details and keep pulling us to the big picture are Ed Graff, ASD's superintendent. Welcome, Ed.
Thank you for having me.
So happy to have you here. And Diane Hirschberg, an education policy expert and the lead author on a recent salary and tenure study done for the Alaska Legislature. Welcome, Diane.
Good afternoon.
So thank you both for being here. I know you're busy people, and we just learned before we came in here that the governor has a new budget. We'd all love to go pouring through it, but we have to wait till after the show. But we hope it's good news for education, right? I'd also like to invite our listeners. You know, this show is for you to ask questions, and we've got two great experts here, the leader of the Anchorage School District and an education policy expert and really a leader in state education policy. And so if you've got questions, give us a call. You can call us at 550-8433 or 1-888-353-5752. And we can also take an email at hometown@alaskapublic.org. All right. So first of all, I just kind of want to introduce you both a little bit more fully. Ed, I told you just before we started that I was delighted to find out that you were a school teacher at Gladys Wood, and you had a whole career here in the school district. And you became a principal, then you became, I don't know, chief academic, et cetera, et cetera. Now you're the superintendent. So do you miss the classroom?
You know, some of the most rewarding experience I've had have been engaging with students in the classroom. So, yes, it's difficult to make that transition away from the classroom. But I will share with you just about an hour ago, I was working with students as we went through the Hour of Code, which I don't know if you know much about that, but it's where everyone focuses on learning about how to code.
I thought you meant coding.
Computer coding. Yeah. So got to interact with students from Lake Otis Elementary who did a fantastic job of instructing me how to do code. And it's been about 30-some years since I've done coding. It looked completely different than what it did today. But so, yeah, it's always nice to reconnect with a classroom and see what this is all about. You know,
right. I think it must be when you need to touch your roots again, go back to the kids and spend time with them. Yeah. Diane, I don't think you've ever taught in an elementary setting, but you've taught in college.
Right. I did a year-long internship in an elementary setting, but not as the instructor of record. So most of my teaching has been at the post-secondary level with forays into guest lecturing. And actually, I was at Bartlett this morning, which was, again, a great reminder of both how bright and wonderful our students are and how important the work is that the teachers are doing there.
Right. And I just kind of want to ask you, how did you end up in education? I mean, you had Ed had parents who were educators. Yep. Maybe that influenced you. What about you, Diane?
I, in college, was in a program called Peace and Conflict Studies, and I wanted to save the world, and I had some people whose focus were education as my instructors, and as I looked at what was going on in the rest of the world, I decided it really came back to the choices made in this country to a great extent, and that led me right back to looking at education and who was getting educated in what ways. And and I was extremely fortunate to have some brilliant educators even in those early decision-making years that led me to pursue the doctorate in education.
Interesting. Okay, because I'm always curious how people choose their path.
Yeah.
So I decided I'd try to launch the show with just a little. I mentioned in the introduction that this is a complicated city and it's a complicated state. So I was going to first invite Ed to just give us the broad brushstroke landscape for the Anchorage School District, just so people get a sense of what we're talking about.
Sure. Thanks, Kathleen. It's always nice to be able to create a basis or some background information for people. But we are obviously one of the largest districts in the nation. We're the largest in the state. We're about 48,000 students. We cover roughly 2,200 square miles in our footprint, which is similar to the size of Rhode Island, all the way from Girdwood out to Mirror Lake and the Chugach area, or Chugach area. We have about 96 different languages that are spoken in the Anchorage School District. We have more than 130 schools and programs, roughly 6,000 permanent employees in the Anchorage School District. And it's a place that meets a lot of different diverse needs. You know, when you look at our demographics, we have close to 42% of our student population are of the white background, ethnic background. And so we're about 57% non-white. So the diversity, the demographics composition of our population has changed over the years as well.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. It makes it a very, for me, it makes this a city that's very interesting to live in. And I know you can look at it different ways. It would be easier if everything was homogenized and one size fits all. It might be easier, but it might be not as interesting as the city we have. Yeah. And also not as rich as the city we have,
right?
Because all these different people bring so much to us. You know,
yeah.
That's the thing that I love about it. So
I often tell a story growing up. I spent my time in rural places in Minnesota, South Dakota, and Alaska, and my parents were educators, and they my father was former military, so he had this travel bug that he never got rid of, you know, when he transitioned from military to education.
Every 2 years you need
to. and I joke now and say, if I could have spent my educational career in Anchorage, I would have probably had a very similar exposure to the rich, diverse cultures rather than having to move every 3 to 4 years across states.
Because it could have been easier, Dad.
You can see it all in our schools right now.
Yeah.
And getting an outstanding education as well in one location has its benefits and advantages.
That's great. Did you go outside to college? Did you go outside and then come back?
I originally started my schooling in post-secondary in Minnesota and then transferred up here because my family was up here at the time, and there was this great student loan forgiveness opportunity. And the year I transferred up here, it went away, but finished up here and then got a job with Anchorage School District. But I got my graduate degree outside.
So now we got a little picture of the Anchorage School District. We're going to sort of turn to Diane, who really has a statewide view, and just sort of invite the same sort of landscape. We're going to focus a lot today on Anchorage because this is where we are, but I still think Anchorage is not alone. There's a whole state out there, and what happens out there influences Anchorage too. So
right. And you know, the diversity of Anchorage is really amazing. But, you know, we have 53 different school districts, and then we have Mount Edgecombe. And those school districts range in size from, you know, 16 pupils to 48,000 pupils. There are no two districts that really look alike. We have geographically the largest school districts in the country. You know, you look at someplace like LKSD with, I'm not going to remember if it's 23 different communities, something along
Lower
those lines.
Lower Yukon, Kuskokwim, is that
right?
Did
and,
I get that?
You know,
right?
and the distances, the you know, places that you can only fly to at certain times of the year, or maybe all year long. You know, you have river access or coastal access or flight, and that's it. And that is something that is it's really it makes it hard to wrap your arms around it, because Anchorage, in many ways, looks like some of the large districts in the lower 48, except that we have these indigenous populations, and we have people that are going back and forth from villages of 100 people to a city of over 300,000. And that brings with it, again, huge learning opportunities, but also some challenges that are not like those that are faced elsewhere in the country.
Mm-hmm. So I just wanted to sort of set that out there, because it's complex, and the students are different. They don't all have, they're not all on the same page. So when you're trying to figure out how to educate them, I'm just sort of stunned by the complexity of it and the difficulty of it. So now I told you guys before the show that my bottom feeling is that no matter what our budget is, we can do a good job with education. And we'll explore a little bit more about that. But I wanted to sort of go to Ed and say one of the pieces of data that's out there is that this school district's biggest budget item is 89% for personnel. And that just doesn't tell you enough. So I thought, tell us what that number means, who's in that number. It makes me think of things like healthcare costs that are probably in that because it's a personnel cost, you know, and sometimes something like the high cost of healthcare can be hidden in a personnel budget. You know what I mean? You might not, you just think, well, what kind of salaries are they all making? You know, so unpack that a little bit for us in the best way you can, Ed.
Well, to start with, you know, I think it's important to recognize where we get our funding, where our money comes from. And in the Anchorage School District, we get close to 57% of our money from the state of Alaska. Mm-hmm. And that's usually in the formula of the BSA, the base student allocation. And then you start to look at the makeup of what's left in those amounts. 32% for Anchorage comes from local. We've had strong local support from our municipality and our taxpayers. And so we're one of six districts that has really been able to provide what is permissible under state statute, the cap, if you will, of local funding. So we've been very grateful and appreciative of that. And then the last amount comes from the federal government, about 11%. So you take a look at all those funds and how we apply the use of those funds into our school system. And you're right, it's roughly 89% of our monies go to salary and benefits of our employees. And Diane can speak to the study that was done recently. When you look at just the salary portion of it, we're not paying what is even the highest in the state, let alone what is probably comparable to what we used to pay in the state of Alaska and across the nation. We've definitely not kept up with those salary increments. And mm-hmm. That's created some challenges for us when you talk about recruitment and retention of positions.
Yeah.
And it's there's a national issue of recruitment and retention in education. And I can speculate as to what the reasons are. But a big part of it in our case has been trying to get the individuals to come into the profession where they can make a living and see a long-term successful income coming forward. But you've got healthcare costs as well, which are a huge, huge part of
every employer is facing that, not just the school district. I mean, the university, the hospital, everybody. Yeah. I almost feel like if we could get our arms around that, it would ease the budgets in other places in some way, you know. So I'm going to go ahead and take a caller. Hi, Thomas. You're on Hometown. You're on Hometown Alaska.
Anchorage. Well, I have a comment. It's not exactly about funding, but it's a concern on education. I have met many beautiful young people from Norvik near Kotzebue, and they have their high school diplomas, and they can scribble their signature if you'll complete the form for them. And I feel that they're not being prepared to come to Anchorage and participate, and that's part of the homeless problem. And that's my concern. I don't know how it has to do with funding, but I feel that they're being cheated.
Well, Thomas, thank you. We did start the show talking about how diverse the Anchorage School District is and how incredibly diverse the state is, and that students are in very many different places culturally and language skill-wise. And I think you're speaking to a little bit of that with your question. So we can kind of chew that over a little bit for you.
Cool. Okay. We'll solve it, won't we? Let's solve it.
Let's solve it. Yes, we want to solve it. Okay. All right. Well, let's just talk about that a little bit on behalf of Thomas.
Yeah, I will say I routinely hear comments from people not in just Alaska, but across the nation about what are our students leaving and graduating with? What skills are they leaving and graduating with? And I will say that it's changing. I mean, again, going back to what I saw today, where students were instructing me on how to code. You know what?
You were the student.
Yeah,
they were the teacher.
Student. And what they're learning is they're learning some logical sequence of application and spatial relations on how you code things. But the piece, to go back to what Thomas mentioned, is are they able to fill out a form? Do they have some of those practical real life experiences? And so we have to make sure that we're using 21st century instructional practices and experiences for our students so that they aren't being taught in isolation. It's not a simple skill set of computation, but it's computation, then applying that through, you know, the actual construction of a home, you know, when you're building a home, or it's looking at those real life applications that we're trying to create for students. So I absolutely believe that's essential. That's what's going to keep a student connected into learning. And I'm not talking about just career technical education experiences, but real life application is Diane was mentioning she was working at Bartlett High School today, and they were looking at projects and developments of things. So for many students, that was their first culminating activity where they put a series of skills that they learned together and presented it. And mm-hmm. you could see, at least from what we were discussing, how some were much more proficient in doing that. And others, this was the first step in that learning process for them. So I think that's what we have to look at in education overall is how are we combining that into real life application mm-hmm. and experiences? Mm-hmm. And that's what's going to make the connection for the student to find their passion and then to be able to pursue that once they do achieve that diploma and graduate.
Diane, jump in.
Yeah, you know, this actually, I think, gets at your question about what we do with limited resources, mm-hmm. because there are very innovative things that we can do. And in particular in our rural schools where students might not have access to the things we have here, the large numbers of teachers, the large numbers of businesses and experiences. But one, thanks to GCI and others, we've had a significant investment in internet resources, which helps. But there's also a conversation that some places are having about, do we have to do it the way we've always done it? Mm-hmm. Whether it's the 9-month school year mm-hmm. and the 6-hour day, whether it's the idea of a teacher who provides the information versus when people are talking about flipped classrooms where the students watch videos and access other resources to get content. And then they come to school to be mentored by the educators in doing these hands-on projects and, mm-hmm. and how to extend what they've learned through these online resources. The other thing in this state is that we've just implemented new standards that are much more rigorous than mm-hmm. the state standards we had
before. I read the news story about that.
Exactly. And so it means we need to do professional development to support educators in how you get that information to the students and some scaffolding around what it means to have higher expectations to hold students to that. And then getting parents and students to understand, yeah, this is hard, but we're all trying to work together to raise the proficiency of students in this 21st century learning world.
Right.
And so I do share the caller's concerns. Certainly at UAA, when we look at students who are coming in and needing to take our preparatory classes, there's unfortunately a, you know, large number of rural students who end up in some of those classes. And what we need to do also is have much more productive conversations between the university and K-12 about our expectations and how can we support K-12 in meeting the needs of their students.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. You know, it made me think about when I was back in the day, and I was telling Ed, I went to Catholic schools because my parents believed that that was essential. But we were all tracked. And mm-hmm. When I was thinking about how diverse the student bodies are, I was thinking that kids teach each other, you know, a kid exposed to someone who's on top of it might think, oh, I knew that. I just didn't say it. Or, you know, so there's a benefit of having all these different skill levels together. What about the other version of sort of tracking people? I hated it. My best mm-hmm. friend was tracked into vocational.
Yep.
She ended up getting an MBA and having her own business and doing all kinds of stuff. But it was a weird thing. They just, you know, and then the others were tracked to go to college, and then others were tracked to maybe be secretarial or have a family.
Right.
You know, it was so rigid. I hated it, you know, but I just throw it out there as it was one strategy that was used.
Well, you know, that's actually what my graduate studies started in. When I was doing my doctorate, I was working with a woman named Jeannie Oakes, who wrote a very famous book called Keeping Track, that showed, at least 20 years ago, that students that were placed in different tracks, that you could see a very strong correlation to socioeconomic status.
Mm-hmm.
And so regardless of a child's ability to learn,
right.
they were placed in a track generally because they were low income, they were non-white, they were not starting with English as a first language.
So presumptions were made about their...
It is. One of the hardest things for teachers to manage in large classes, and this gets back to resources, is having a very broad array of prior learning experiences for students. It's not abilities. Kids can learn, but they may not have had the opportunity to learn before they got into that classroom. So now you're talking differentiated instruction, mm-hmm. where you really need to customize what you're doing to meet your kids at different levels and bring them up. And so, there's strategies, mm-hmm. but that takes supporting teachers in those strategies. And frankly, if we're not investing enough to give teachers class sizes that they can do this in, mm-hmm. then you start saying, all I can do is group these kids by ability because...
You end up doing that.
It's a way to manage large class sizes and lower, less resources. It's tough.
Which is not, I mean, that's not what I'm trying to suggest here. I want to deal with the question of tight budgets because it's reality, but I don't want to paint a doom and gloom picture.
Right.
I mean, I'm going to press for... There's got to be solutions. I mean, creativity, that's
yes.
what we're about, you know. So let's see. We started with the 89%, and I think Ed answered that. And then we were going to sort of segue into sort of the salary, because we are talking about teachers, attracting teachers, keeping mm-hmm. teachers. So update us on that report you did for the legislature. And I'm interested in the next step, because I think I know what you're going to jump in, Ed. Go
well,
ahead.
Before Diane goes into that, I don't want to miss an opportunity to talk
sure.
about, you know, the obligation I believe we have, which is to have high quality teachers in mm-hmm. every one of our schools across the state and in every one of our classrooms across the state. I think that's first and foremost. And how we get high quality teachers, in some part, will go back to our recruitment efforts, but it also goes back to the connection Diane made working with the university to make sure that we're on the same page. If we have needs in terms of the quality of outcomes that we're not getting at our high schools or entry level into secondary school, post-secondary, we've got to come together and address that. Mm-hmm. But we absolutely have an obligation to provide high quality teachers in all of our classrooms. Mm-hmm. The second piece is that we have an obligation to all students to make sure that they receive the standards that they're expected to be able to achieve. So the idea of, you know, deferring exposure to these standards because they're too difficult and going over to remediate or to provide intervention, I think those are conversations and opportunities that can happen. But first, we have to make sure that they get the core exposure to the standards. I think when we start to replace that with other forms of standards or materials, we sometimes jump to that too quickly.
Mm-hmm.
And that's not how it should be.
It doesn't really give us the result we need.
No, we have to have that foundation exposure, and then you can build from that. And it does, for some students, it takes more time because they don't have the background information. They have not had the exposure to mm-hmm. some of these experiences. Mm-hmm. But so we cannot dismiss the importance of high-quality teachers as well as providing that core curriculum for kids.
And I'm going to jump in and just throw out our phone numbers again just before we go to Diane. So we're at 550-8433 in Anchorage or 1-888-353-5752. And we can also take an email at hometown@alaskapublic.org. So where were we? We were talking about, you're talking about high quality teachers. You're talking about, you know, a solution. Well, if we can just pay them a ton of money, maybe they'll, you know, that was the pipeline boom
right.
era when we had those salaries, I think, because basically to keep them from the salary scale was set so high by the oil industry that everything had to be that high. Am I right? I mean, that's generally a historical view.
Well, I think it's that we actually had the resources to set
and
salaries
we had the resources.
High. And then we knew that, you know, one way to attract educators is to pay them very well. It's not the only piece of the equation, though. You know, when we did this statewide salary and tenure study, we were also looking at research that we had recently done surveying teachers across the state on why they decided to stay or go. And there's a very strong correlation with not feeling supported either by your school administration or by your community with teachers' decisions to leave. And, you know, it's a two-way street when you have teachers saying, I don't feel supported by the parents in the community. And you also, in some communities, have parents saying, I don't feel like the school wants to engage us. You know, mm-hmm.
there's
conversation
of some sort,
we need to be having.
Uh-huh.
But our study that we did, the legislature asked us to propose a statewide salary schedule. And it was based on both setting the right base and then having, we're all familiar with the cost differentials.
Mm-hmm.
And we didn't do, it's not the same geographic cost differentials that we use in the school funding formula, but it was geographic cost differentials to say, in your community, how much more do you need to pay than this base salary in order to attract and retain high quality teachers? And it varies enormously by community. And some of the factors are living conditions. You know, how much does it cost if your family's in the lower 48 to fly from the village to the hub to Anchorage outside? Mm-hmm. Degree heating and cooling days. You know, some of us are a little wimpy when it comes to living in colder parts mm-hmm. of the state. What is the poverty level in the community? Because often that's a proxy for kids that have more needs when they come to mm-hmm. school. Mm-hmm. So a bunch of these factors. And what you find is there's a lot of communities where we need to be paying more. And in some cases, the numbers came up as hugely more. In Anchorage, it came up with about 10% more. And we feel like that's really a representation of the cost of living and the challenges in working in large and complex schools. In the communities where our formula was saying we need to pay 100% more, 75% more, we're having even internal disputes in our team because some of us are saying, well, that's what the formula says. You want to keep them, pay them more. Others of us are saying, well, that's assuming things don't change in that school. And maybe that money needs to be invested not just in teacher salaries, but also in helping principals work better with community members. There's been a lot of investment in teacher housing, but not in all communities. Maybe we need to get the places that still have honey buckets have a different mm-hmm. option mm-hmm. for those teachers and mm-hmm. those communities. So there's a lot of factors that are going to drive a teacher's decision to stay in a community. And we want to think about those as a package because, frankly, I'm not sure I want teachers who are simply coming because we're paying them more than we pay
they
most
just see
other
dollar
professionals
signs in there.
Exactly. You know,
that's, I want to take a caller here. Yeah. Just one second. Monica, welcome to Hometown Alaska.
Hello, Waka. My name is Monica, and I'm from Bethel, Alaska, and I am a Yupik Eskimo woman with three children who is also has a bachelor's of elementary education and some experience with the Lower Kuskokwim School District. And my initial comment was going to be on the diversity or disparities between cultural education between Alaska Native individuals and non-Native people, as well as different multicultural students and families that we have in the Anchorage or around the state, but specifically here in Anchorage, and how to address that with teachers who are coming in from out of the state of Alaska who are teaching our children, who are teaching my children, and how to entice them or kind of bring them in so that education is successful at every level, not just in reading, writing, and math, but when we're looking at social skills, when we're looking at the different standards for education, and looking at that from the perspective of not only being at a school on the road system, but also looking at it in our rural areas, because I am from rural Alaska, and there's so many points that you're bringing up that I'm thinking that this all ties to. It ties to cultural competencies between educators and the students mm-hmm. and their communities, ties to teacher retention, ties to educational performance, ties to state standard testing. It applies to so many things. And not just the student, but it ties to their communities and how successful that school is going to be in that particular community, whether it's in South Anchorage or if it's in Tutuliak or mm-hmm. if it's in Kalskeg.
Right.
Those are very big questions, I guess, that I had or concerns that I have that I have seen firsthand.
Right.
And it's something I feel like that needs to be addressed so all students in Alaska can have that success and that strive for education, whether or not they want to go on to college or if they want to go into the military or if they just want to get an average job.
Right.
You know, the success should not just be a certificate from a college.
Mm-hmm. I appreciate your comments. They're so thoughtful. And I feel like you should be on the show with us today. and we're lucky that you called in. I guess I want to ask you about answers to the, you know, what would help in your mind? You've got, you know, you've got the background, you've got the life experience, the cultural experience. What would help in some of these areas that are so challenging for us? We're, you know, it's almost like we're more than one country in one state. I mean, we're so varied and I don't know. Do you have thoughts about that?
And it's not just among Alaska Native cultures. There's a very large, you know, Asian community and Pacific community in Anchorage. And, you know, it's so diversified. And not anyone is the right way to go. But I think what teachers need to understand is their own personal beliefs about culture, even within their own families or their own lives and upbringing, affects the way that they teach. Mm-hmm. And it could thereby affect that student, no matter what age they are, their outlook on education. Is it going to be a positive one? Is it going to be meaningful? When I used to do trainings with my school district, part of it was, you know, everybody think back on one good point in your education and how it was a positive thing for you. If the teacher was nice to you, what did they say? Did you do well on a test? Or think of a time where you didn't have a good experience in school, and people can come up with those experiences, their own personal mm-hmm. experiences, and how
I'm
to
thinking of
their
them
education.
Now. Yeah. It's anybody
and that's,
can.
I think, one
yeah.
way to help make it real and successful for teachers in rural Alaska. If they come into a community where they have no idea about the culture from what they read from a book, it's very different from living it.
Yeah, yeah.
And they're not prepared. And if they come in and we've had teachers come in on the midday flight and leave on the evening flight, mm-hmm. that affects the classroom.
Yes.
That affects the families and the teachers and the kids in the
right.
community thinking, I'm not worth it.
Right, yeah. right. They're not going to stay with us, and so we just got X'd out. Yeah. We're going to take a little break, but I just want to invite either of you, do you want to comment on anything that Monica said? I mean, we're getting a lot of heads shaking, yes, yeah. silently in agreement with you, Monica, but anything else? Food for thought, Monica, really good commentary.
Yeah, the culture we have here, the cultural diversity we have here in Alaska is an invaluable resource, and Monica, you hit the nail on the head. I always go back to, you know, it's about this student experience and what they encounter in the schools that makes a difference. And we have to be able to, if we haven't had exposure to a specific culture, we have to be able to understand the cultural responsiveness practices that come from someone who has a different culture than us and be reflective in how we approach that.
Mm-hmm.
I haven't been to Africa, but I understand going into a community and a culture, being of a different ethnic background, and that there are different customs and traditions, and trying to bring that into the classroom for everyone to experience and appreciate mm-hmm. is what we're all about. Because, you know, for us to be successful in a global economy and society, you have to have those 21st century skills.
Mm-hmm.
I mean,
that's
essentially what we're doing.
The world is much smaller now than it used to be. Yeah. Anything you want to add, Diane? And then we'll just take a quick break.
Yeah. So Monica brought up so many good points. One of them, in terms of cultural competency, we have, over the years, have had a number of initiatives to try to give teachers experiences to make them successful, whether it's the Alaska Humanities Forum's different initiatives around providing culture camps. We had the old Alaska Partnership for Teacher Enhancement that did summer content programs in villages. I got to spend a couple summers in Accucheck through that, working with that. North Slope Borough School District takes teachers out to culture camps. The problem is these tend to be funded through federal grants. They last for 3 years, 5 years. They hit a certain number of teachers, and then they're over. And we don't have a systemic, sustained
approach.
It's expensive, but communities providing these experiences, it makes a huge difference.
Yeah.
The other piece that I think Monica was getting at was, in many of our rural communities, the educators who are coming in from outside and are trying to learn the culture are coming into institutions that are still structured very different from the culture of the community, and the community doesn't feel like the institution is theirs. And mm-hmm. in research we did looking at the most successful schools serving Indigenous populations, whether it was Greenland or Hawaii or tribal schools in Lower 48, community ownership mm-hmm. and some measure of self-determination. It may not be that these are tribal schools, but I'm sure she knows Ayaprenelit Narvik, where mm-hmm. the parents and the community and the educators together mm-hmm. own the school, and it becomes a place that reflects all of those that are within it. And I think that changes the experience mm-hmm. for the children and the educators and the parents.
Mm-hmm. Well, we're going to take a break. I just want to remind our listeners, if you joined us and you're wondering who are those eloquent voices on the radio, it's Ed Graff, the superintendent of the Anchorage School District, and Diane Hirschberg, the director of the Center for Alaska Education Policy Research, and lead author of this recent salary and tenure study that we were talking about. So you're listening to Hometown Alaska, and I'm Kathleen McCoy.
You're listening to Hometown Alaska from Alaska Public Media. The program repeats tonight at 8 p.m. on KSKA Anchorage and will not be taking phone calls. You can find Hometown Alaska on iTunes or listen at alaskapublic.org.
Welcome back to Hometown Alaska. I'm your host, Kathleen McCoy. And today's topic is school finance. And if you've listened to the first half hour, we've roamed widely to cultural diversity and all kinds of things. But we're really looking at success. And I'm thinking that just a dollar sign doesn't guarantee success. There's a lot of other pieces to this. So we're back now, and we have got Diane Hirschberg from the Center for Alaska Education Policy Research, and we have Ed Graff, the superintendent of the Anchorage School District. And we're sort of going to open the second half. I attended one of the school district's community forums. They've had four of them. There's another one tonight, I think at Mears, from maybe 6 to 8, maybe. And really, this was a sort of a listening session. But Ed, I was just in the audience. You were there. Go ahead
sure,
and describe
Kathleen,
it.
It's a combination of things. And you know, every year we go through a budget development process, and as we reflect on how successful it was and what level of engagement we have for the community, we refine that. And so this year we've taken a hybrid approach where we are providing education or information to the public. We're trying to make sure that they see not only where we get our funding, but what the forecast looks like, mm-hmm. and then also engagement and getting their feedback. And last year the school board did a listening session where they actually had an open mic and community members could come forward and share their thoughts, and we took that into consideration mm-hmm. when we developed our budget. But we wanted to go back to what we did a couple of years ago, where we actually asked questions of the public and got them to give us more information rather than just an open mic. So the community sessions, as they are now, they start with about a 5 to 10 minute overview from me and my staff around the funding mechanisms that we have for public education in our district. And then we open it up to questions where the community members get to use clickers and respond to specific questions. And then we go back to table groups, and they're asked, you know, to articulate what it is that they value, to expand on, you know, why they answered the way they answered. So really trying to capture
and
some of those conversations. Yeah.
Uh-huh. Yeah.
So we're pulling all that information together, and we'll provide a presentation to the school board at our next meeting on the 14th for mm-hmm. that first part of information, which is our community dialogue. Mm-hmm. And then we also have a second part, which we've added this year, which is an online engagement platform through Thought Exchange. And the first bit of information went out to the public where we had, I think, close to 2,700 people respond, and they provided more than 15,000 thoughts and comments.
Mm. And well, so that's encouraging. I mean, my worry is that the complexity of funding schools just sends people into the closet, and I can't deal with it. I don't even know the question to ask, or I don't even know the suggestion to make because it's so complicated.
And
so
we get a lot of that through the conversations.
Yeah.
And so what I try and reassure people is that even if you had a lot of information, it's still difficult to process.
Right.
So this online platform now, moving to the second phase, which opens today and will close on December 18th, any member of the community can weigh in on it. And so there are a series of different categories, and they get to rank and identify what they think is most valuable.
This is on a website, right?
If you go to our district webpage, you'll be able to see the information on the budget, and there should be a link connection there starting today where they can then participate in Thought Exchange. And it will be open until I believe the 18th of December.
And does it ask specific questions? The district's website is asdk12.org.
Yes, asdk12.org. And then if you go in there, and you'll see right at the top of the page, it talks about the join the conversation about the school budget, and you can click there to read more. And
I'm going to invite people to join the discussion on the budget right now by throwing out our phone numbers at 550-8433 in Anchorage, or 1-888-353-5752. Or you can send us an email at hometown@alaskapublic.org. Well, I want to comment on being at the one at Wendler, because it was very endorsing of the school district. It was very endorsing of teachers. You know, it was very endorsing of practices that people recognize as good. And I was sitting next to someone in the back of the room who said, yeah, but how are they going to pay for all that? So, you know, what are you doing with the information? Is it important that you hear so many people saying those things? Does that give you clout with the legis? I don't know. How are, other than just devising your budget, the fact that people want these things for their children, and they're not just focusing on a number and it has to get down to a certain number. I mean, I don't know. What do you do with that?
Well, it's really important to understand what people value. You know, when you go through a budget development and you have to make some hard decisions and trade-offs, you know, if we can't generate more revenue, you know, we're limited as to how we get our revenue and funding. You have to be able to say, you know, this is what we heard people value. This is what we see in terms of the data behind this. Mm-hmm. And so you make an informed decision based on the information that you have at that time. Mm-hmm. So rather than just chasing something that someone says cut or, you know, do this, mm-hmm. you want to have a real understanding of what it is that's valued so that you don't lose sight of that. You mm-hmm. don't throw away one thing to chase down yeah. another.
And I mean, I even believe I saw people saying, don't cut anything. Right. That was an option, don't cut. There was some discussion of transportation issues, and I didn't quite follow that. I wasn't sure if they were saying, don't cut transportation or do, but there was some discussion about it.
Yeah, we get funding from the state, and currently the services we provide are funding services that are provided through routes and support of students. The money from the state does not cover our current expenditures.
Okay.
So we have to make some decisions with that. We will be operating at about a $2 million gap moving forward. And so how do you address that? Mm-hmm. You have to either reduce the routes and services that you provide, or you have to shift your funds into
from someplace else,
into that
into
model.
Transportation.
And
yeah.
I think that's important for people to understand, because I know living in Alaska, you know, with the inclement weather that we have and the road conditions, sometimes, you know, people really value our transportation. Mm-hmm. But there are trade-offs that have to occur. And mm-hmm. I'm going to come back to, you know, first of all, making sure that we're providing a safe environment for our students and that it focuses on our students. And so mm-hmm. it's really important for us to hear from the public, especially parents and individuals who have mm-hmm. children in our schools, mm-hmm. just how much they value those resources yeah. that we're providing.
You know, I wonder, I mean, I've said it a couple times here, I worry that the audience drifts away because they don't understand. And I this is a question for you too, Diane. It's so important to keep people engaged, and are we not doing something? Because I mean, at the Wendler meeting, I think there were maybe 35 or 40 people, and my first impression was there were a lot of teachers there, and then it turned out there were teachers with children in the school district. So, but I was sort of expecting a full auditorium of people saying, I want this and I want that. You know, it was more modest, more very civil, and I'm thankful for that. You know, we don't need more uncivilized conversation. But I thought I would see more disturbance. I don't know if that's the right way to put it, or more agitation or more concern. There was definitely concern in the room. I don't mean to suggest there wasn't, but it wasn't an audience filled with lots of different kinds of people that were worried about public education. And I just feel like a lot of things get so complex, like healthcare, for example. People just can't follow it, and they tend to check out. And I'm thinking about you, Diane, trying to, you know, you deal with policy and teacher education, but you're also very focused on the engagement picture. You know,
right.
We have to have the schools people want. I don't know. Do you have any thoughts? I know that's a very broad question, and tackle it any way you can.
I do. Well, one of the issues I think you're getting at is the school funding, if you just look at the formula, it's complicated.
Yeah.
It's got a lot of calculations. But there's some things, and we've actually had this very productive conversation in a different project with Anchorage School District about, so what do we think is ideal?
Mm-hmm.
You know, starting from, and it's a question that the state has not asked in this way, which is, really, what should our schools look like if we want to get the outcomes we want?
Mm-hmm.
We've tended to discuss spending in our schools based on how much we want to spend, which is a different question from how do we get to the outcomes
mm-hmm.
that we want to see. And so things like national research that says, well, an ideal ratio in a high school class is about 25 to 1, and an ideal ratio in a first grade class is about 15 to 1.
Mm-hmm.
All right, that's a starting point that's really concrete, but again, the state has not really had that as the starting point mm-hmm. in all of the discussions. We've had very productive conversations about how do we make sure that we've got an equitable distribution of the resources that we have. Mm-hmm. So the foundation formula that says we're going to give, you know, we're going to have this geographic cost differential because it's more expensive in Shishmaref than it is in Anchorage. And special education costs more than working with kids without special needs. But after that, we don't start from, but at the base, what do we need to spend to take this child from when they walk into our school through to graduation to be able to, as Monica pointed out, make the choice. Do I go to college? Do I go right into the workforce? Do I go to the military? Mm-hmm. Do I become the best darn subsistence hunter who also earns a cash mm-hmm. living in part-time work at Red Dog Mine? Mm-hmm. You know, we need our graduates to have all these options, and we need to be working from how we get them there and what it's going to cost. And, yeah, right now we're in a terrible position in terms of the state's finances. But if we don't continue to invest in our young people, we may be in a worse position 10 years from
it's
now.
Sort of like you can invest in education or you invest in programs afterwards.
Exactly.
That take care of people's inability to be successful, I
exactly.
guess. You know, they just don't, as Ed said, the 21st century skills.
Yeah.
So they can thrive. So, I mean, is anybody even asking those questions, or how do you get that on the table?
You know, the legislation that funded or that called for the teacher salary and tenure study actually called for four studies: a facility study, an equity study that looked at the foundation formula, the salary and tenure study, and an adequacy study. And the adequacy study did not get done.
That's the one you're talking about, is the adequacy
yeah,
study.
Yeah, because unfortunately the time frame in which the RFP came out with a certain amount of time to do the study with a certain amount of money, and nobody said that was enough time or enough money. So it didn't happen. Mm-hmm. And Anchorage has asked of itself the same questions that the state would be asking in that study, which I think is just amazing.
Is that ongoing now, Ed?
We are actually finalizing. We had an executive summary presented to the school board by Larry Pikus, and Diane was a part of that conversation at the last board meeting. But uh-huh. we're working on reconciling some of those internal numbers.
Yeah.
But most definitely, when you look at the evidence-based model that they have, they've time and time again identified 10 key strategies that you would implement in any district, you know, and then you have to get into the details of it, you know, which usually includes counting people and money uh-huh. and everything
and money.
Else.
Right.
But there are some key tenets to a school-based improvement
it's
model.
Sort of going at it instead of like, okay, we got this pot of money, and are we? And now you want more,
right?
You know,
right.
versus it costs this much to deliver a high school graduate that's ready for whatever yeah. their choices that they
yes.
are making.
It really is best practices in any kind of improvement plan, whether it's a self-improvement plan. If you're going to go out and say, I want to live a healthier life, you don't just start piling things onto what you're doing. You mm-hmm. do an analysis mm-hmm. of where you are in existence, mm-hmm. and then you identify through research and evidence-based what are some of those key tenets of a successful, healthy practice.
Right.
And that's what we're doing. And that takes time. It takes resources to do that. And then from there, it's going to take more conversations and a commitment to support that.
Will. Let me throw out our phone numbers again. It's 550-8433 in Anchorage, 1-888-353-5752 statewide, or you can email us at hometown@alaskapublic.org. And if you've just tuned in, you're listening to this conversation about school finance and school success. Our guests are Ed Graff, the superintendent of the Anchorage School District, who began his career as a teacher at Gladys Wood. I just love knowing that. And then Diane Hirschberg, the director of the Center for Alaska Education Policy Research, which is housed in Iser mm-hmm. at UAA, and also responsible for a large part of that tenure and salary study that we've just been talking about, which is, you know, how to keep teachers. And basically, we didn't tell people the end result of the study, which was we can't afford it. Is that right?
Well, it was that we're looking at the fiscal situation and we're looking at our findings in terms of what some districts would have to pay in order to use our model. And our sense is that we also don't want, frankly, that having a statewide salary schedule takes away local control for saying, this is really the way we need to invest our money. I've actually talked to several superintendents and school business officers since we released the study. And one of the things is the people in those districts understand the conditions best. So when we're saying in some of our districts that there's this huge variation in what our model calls for paying, whether it's in Homer or in Nikolaevsk or Port Graham, the district can then say, gee, do we pay bonuses for teachers who are willing to teach in the more remote communities? Do we think about changing the housing options? You know, that's a local decision that's best made by people within there. What they can do is take our information now and use that to help them see systematically what our data says might help them in recruiting and retaining teachers. But we just, the other piece was there was a question about whether or not tenure should be changed. And two pieces. One is, again, the value of tenure is enormous to teachers. I mean, we're talking $34,000 a year was the estimate of the value of tenure to the teachers who responded to a survey we put out. So you would have to pay them a lot more if you weren't going to guarantee them the rights that tenure gives you. And you know, tenure's not about keeping poor performing teachers. Tenure is about protecting the due process rights of educators.
So bad teachers, there can be a path to thank them for their service and
yes, you can get rid of a poor teacher. It takes some documentation, but it is very doable. And we had a number of administrators say, "Oh yeah, I have no problem if a teacher is not doing their job getting rid of them."
Yeah, you know, I have. We're talking about how complicated it is, the formulas and the eyes glazing over, sort of. And then I think about our legislature. It's a citizen legislature. You know, trying to make hard decisions. And my question is, do they, what kind of backgrounding do they get? I mean, I imagine people take trips, you go in and you make your best case, but do they get grounding in the things they have to make decisions? Is there, does the State Department of Education provide how do they get grounded for the decisions they have to make? And that's, maybe we don't know the answer. Maybe, I don't know. You're both looking at me and not sure.
Well, I can tell you, I met with three legislators last week and talked about, last session and moving forward and talked about just some of the educational needs. And I feel from my position, that's my job, is to demonstrate or communicate what the needs are and what the opportunities are if we meet those needs and what the challenges are if we don't meet those needs.
Right.
So I think we have an obligation also to work with the legislators to provide that information and be available when they have questions and be responsive to that.
But they might see you as a lobbyist, lobbying for the Anchorage School District. I mean, I'm looking for I was thinking about the way ISER sometimes does third party, independent third. Do they get that kind of information? And I don't know. And maybe we don't know.
Well, I think a lot of it depends on who's in the legislature, what kind of information they seek out. When I was doing research in the legislature years ago, there were legislators who talked about taking groups out to rural schools and rural communities so that people from Anchorage or from Juneau could see firsthand what it was like to live and work in some of our smaller and more remote places. Likewise, I know there's a big effort to invite Anchorage legislators into schools. This year, unfortunately, there was a special session happening right in the middle of when that usually happens. But I know schools love being visited by lawmakers who can see what is happening and understand from a much more experiential sense the challenges as well as the brilliant stuff that's happening in our schools.
I'm empathetic to the problem.
Well, I also say, Kathleen, we have an emphasis in the Anchorage School District for the last 2 years now where February is identified as Visit Our Schools Month, and we specifically put out information to all members of the public and community to come in and get a tour of a neighborhood school, an alternative program, a charter school, any part of the public schools that we have in the Anchorage School District so that we can demonstrate and show people what's happening. Too often people will say, I think this is what's going on. I heard this is what's going on.
You might see one or two news stories that don't really give you they give you the news, but they don't give you the
And we want to give them that firsthand experience. Granted, it's a tour, but you'll at least get to see, the students in action, the facility, and what things look like in a 21st century learning environment. And it's vastly different from when I went to school well as when many, many members of the community went to school here, even in Anchorage.
Yeah. I just want to respond to an email we had. A caller is really interested in knowing how to participate in Thought Exchange. So let's run through that one more time. Just give them the site. It's the ASDK12.org.
It's on our website. You should be able to go into our main webpage. You'll see the image of the budget conversations, and it says click here for more. You click on that, and there'll be information specifically to online engagement for Thought Exchange, and that's happening today. It's starting today, so if it's not immediately up there, I didn't have time to check before I came over here, but certainly look back to that page, yeah. And we'll have information out there.
Here's a question, Ed. I noticed on the website, I went and looked at your FAQs, and I thought they were really helpful for me as a journalist coming to try to understand. Will people get to read what other people said? I mean, will you compile this information?
Yes, we will. You're talking about the community dialogues that took place?
Yes, and the Thought Exchange, too.
Yep, all that information will be made available to the public. So the public dialogue conversations will be presented in an executive summary for our next board meeting on December 14th. Mm-hmm. And then the Thought Exchange, because that is going through I believe the 18th or the 19th, they won't have that compiled until mm-hmm. January 4th, which is our first board meeting for the new school year. And so mm-hmm. they'll provide an executive summary for that. And then we'll have those documents available for the public to review.
Okay, so good. So if people are just getting into the groove of it.
They're not too late.
They're not too late. Nope. That's great to know. Well, I know I wanted to talk about funding. And one thing, I just being an outsider, I wondered, the Anchorage School District offers so much. My daughter was an open optional student. She took AP. She got to swim. I mean, it was a great experience. But I'm thinking about the many different, like the ABC, the charter, the language immersion. Do those things cost more money? Are they at all in any jeopardy? Because I think people value the variety of opportunity that we have in the school district.
Well, we do offer a lot of opportunities for our students, and I think, again, what we're trying to do is meet the individual needs and collectively the mm-hmm. needs of all students. But a lot of those opportunities came out because that's what our community wants and expects. Mm-hmm. They've grown to expect that, mm-hmm.
So
choice.
Someone in an office didn't dream this up and say, let's have language immersion. You take it from the community.
In part, we take it from the community, but we also look at what the evidence is out there and the research behind, you know, when you have a system like ours, you know, what are ways to meet different needs mm-hmm. for students to be successful, not mm-hmm. only in their experiences in the school setting, but mm-hmm. once they graduate from school and beyond, what do they need to have available for them to navigate, you know, global mm-hmm. society? So that's a critical part of what's
happening.
They don't
necessarily, not having those doesn't necessarily save money is sort of what I'm hearing. I mean, it's like you're offering students need.
It goes back to what is our goal? You know, what do you value? And we want to make sure that the students are, first of all, in a safe learning experience environment. Mm-hmm. And we also want to make sure they're engaged. And mm-hmm. so we're about making sure our students engage. We need high quality teachers to do that. And we also need great experiences for our students.
Great. Well, as you can hear the music, we're out of time. I want to thank Ed Graff, superintendent of the Anchorage School District, Diane Hirschberg, director of the Center for Alaska Education Policy Research, housed over in Iser at UAA, and one of the leaders on that study that we were just talking about. Thank you both for taking time out of busy days to come and see us. Next week on Hometown Alaska, I'll be back as your host. Our topic is village dogs and the community groups that successfully relocate them from rural communities to dog-hungry population centers like Anchorage. Hometown Alaska is on the web at alaskapublic.org. Pat Yak is the chief content officer. Dave Waldron was our audio engineer today. Thanks for joining us on Hometown Alaska. I'm Kathleen McCoy.
Hometown Alaska is a production of Alaska Public Media, which is solely responsible for its content. Views expressed are those of the host and participants and do not reflect the underwriters or KSKA. Hometown Alaska's theme song, Lead Dog, is by Kevin Barnett from Eagle River. Learn more about Hometown Alaska and listen online at alaskapublic.org. Life Informed. This is Alaska Public Media.